You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we're going to be talking with Tom Philpott, one of my very, very favorite guests. I'd like to have Tom almost every week if I could, but I know that isn't right, so I don't. But I mean, really, honestly, he is the best. So Tom is, in case you're not familiar, he is the food and agriculture reporter for Mother Jones Magazine, and he is also the author of Perilous Bounty, The Looming Collapse of American Farming and How We Can Prevent It. That's a must read, people, a must read, now in paperback. So if you haven't gotten a copy, please get one and read it. Honestly, you will, your jaw will drop, your eyes will open wide, and you will learn an awful lot. So Tom, I contacted you because you had a short piece with Mother Jones about the Investment Recovery Act and the bits of it that pertain to food and agriculture. And one of the things that jumped out, as you said, the good news was that there was a lot of money for conservation stewardship programs, which have already been funded for, a few decades, right? But the fact that the program has been expanded enormously will have, I hope, a very big impact on the nation's soil content and soil recovery, shall we say. So talk about that for a little bit and tell us what we can expect.
Yeah, so the Inflation Recovery Act, you know, I think we think of it mostly as a climate bill. It was a way to get Joe Manchin to sign off on a climate bill. And also it's funded by some tax increases. And so there's a whole bunch of compromising going on here.
Yes.
And, you know, I think basically the outline of the bill is to try without regulation to get the whole economy to move away from fossil fuels by setting up a bunch of carrots to get existing industries to do better. Most of them are about electric utilities, but as I noted in my piece, there are some in there for agriculture.
Yeah.
There was a fairly significant expansion of a couple of the programs. So it puts the IRA puts $20 billion over 10 years into USDA conservation programs. And the biggest one of those, the most important one, I think, is the Conservation Stewardship Program. And it pays farmers to, it basically helps farmers defray some costs from doing some things that would be good for the environment. Things like planting cover crops. There are big portions of the Midwest where soil erosion happens every year because ground is kept uncovered. This is a very highly erodible land, and we know where that land is. And so this these programs would potentially pay farmers to put it in permanent, perennial, stuff like grass, all year round, take it out of production. And there isn't a lot of incentive to do that currently. So this would give, programs that would pay them to do it to give them incentives.
Right.
And all that's really good. And so we're talking about, basically over the next 4 years, the current budget for the Conservation Reserve Program is about $1.8 billion. So this is going to add over the next 4 years only $3.5 billion. So that's a huge increase. That's basically tripling the budget. That's good. I have to say that there are a lot of problems with this approach. One of them is that, basically U.S. farm, I didn't get into this in my piece, but like U.S. farm policy puts a lot of money into, propping up, the fact that in the Midwest, farmers essentially plant two crops, and that's corn and soybeans.
Right.
And this there's a lot of money going into propping that up, billions of dollars. This doesn't tell them they have to change that or try to make them change that. It's essentially softening the blow of how environmentally destructive that is. And I wrote about it at length in my book, Perilous Bounty. But this is like a fairly minor, improvement over the status quo. But the status quo, it's not changing the fact that the status quo
remains
the status quo. Exactly. And I think it gets at, something that I think that we'll make a bit of a theme of in this episode. And that is that the Biden administration in general, and I think mostly pushed into this corner by Joe Manchin, who has got all this power because, it's essentially the deciding vote in the Senate.
Yes.
The basic policy towards climate change is, okay, we can't push an actual regulation through. We can't tell utilities that they have to use less coal and gas. But what we can do is create carrots to incentivize them to use more wind and solar. And something similar is going on here with agriculture. There's it's not even in the public debate to tell farmers that you can't use practices that erode soil or lead to polluted water.
Right.
What we will do is we'll throw you some money to sort of mitigate some of that stuff. And that's where we are here. And I think in the Biden administration, there are some people who understand that you need more decisive action on climate change. But in the agriculture department, Mr. Vilsack, Tom Vilsack, the USDA secretary, is not one of those people. He's very dedicated to this all carrots, no sticks approach.
He is. And of course, he's a former governor of Iowa himself. So corn and soy are a big part of that economy. And he certainly isn't going to do anything that's going to change that status quo. Let's talk a little bit about the fact, because I really want to get to this partnerships for climate smart commodities. But I do want to address another thing that was that you brought up in your piece. It looks like Black farmers or people of color will finally get the assistance that was promised to them in the American Rescue Plan, but which was then thwarted by lawsuits that alleged, quote unquote, discriminatory racial preferences. I'm not even going to touch that. It's so insane. Explain how the roadblocks have been averted. And then also talk just for a minute about some of the history of racial discrimination in terms of loans and land grabbing and, an inability to secure title to your land. Because I don't think that many Americans are really aware of just how many decades, if not centuries, this bias against people of color in farming has been going on. And then also, and of course, I asked the multi-part question. I'm such an idiot. But but the USDA has a long history of discrimination. So I, sort of tie those threads together for us. Would you, Tom?
Sure. It is. I've done a couple of articles in the past couple of years on this. And
yeah.
It is a really shocking story. It's sort of worse. It's one of those things that's, when you look at it deeply, it's worse than you think.
Yeah.
And, what the situation is, basically the Civil War ends, slavery is over, the Southern landholders have been, farm owners have had their labor liquidated, their chattel labor liquidated.
Right.
And so there's this potential to address the horrific crime of slavery. There's this potential basically as reparations for that right then and there in 1865 to grant land to formerly enslaved people. And in fact, that actually, as everyone knows, that happened in 1865, the whole 40 acres and a mule order was really a massive tract of land, basically from, some distance in from coastal Florida, I'm sorry, from coastal Georgia all the way down to central Florida was going to be, 40 acre plots given to formerly enslaved African Americans. And it wasn't even going to be the only bit of land reform that happened. It was just sort of the first part of it. And of course, Lincoln gets assassinated. The guy who takes over is a, just very pro-slavery figure. And Reconstruction, this is a centerpiece of Reconstruction. He sets about gutting Reconstruction, basically from the beginning. So that never happened. But really by miracle, freed slaves in the post-Civil War era built up over the next 60 years pretty substantial land holdings. And it was basically people banding to, you know, banding the resources together, forming cooperatives, helping each other out.
Yes.
And, you know, this is through the period of like the just KKK and just brutal.
That's right.
Racist backlash against them. And so you get to 1920 and Black Americans own, now I'm going to, I don't have the figures right in front of me, but over 100 million acres of farmland, you know, around mid-1920s.
Right.
And what happens then, and I think this is the part of the story that often gets lost. So this, what the decades to come are the decades of the industrialization of agriculture, right? The scaling
right.
up, the switch from, you know, horsepowered plows to mechanical tractors powered by gasoline and later diesel, and buying expensive hybrid seeds, using a lot more chemicals, fertilizers, pesticides. So the U.S. farm system is in this period of scaling up, and the USDA was right in the middle of that. And so what the USDA is promoting that, and what they're doing is they're giving lots and lots and lots of loans to farmers that are guaranteed by the federal government, saying, you know, borrow this money, buy these seeds, invest in these pesticides, invest in this tractor, you know, scale up. If your neighbor's going to sell out and doesn't want to do this, then, you know, you buy their land and scale up. And so this process is happening, but the USDA, you know, so most of this African-American owned farmland is in the U.S. South. And the USDA is very, the farm loan programs of the USDA are very localized. There's county offices.
That's right.
And these county offices systematically shut out African-American farmers.
Right.
And so what happened, so the USDA has got its fingers all over this. And so if you're an African-American farmer, suddenly your neighbor, their yield is skyrocketing because they've been able to use these industrial means to grow their food. So prices for commodities are plunging. You can't compete on price. You're getting undercut. You can't make your costs. You try to go get a loan to get your tractor and, you know, they won't even listen to you.
Right.
And so what you get starting around, you know, 1930 is this systematic dispossession of farmland driven by the USDA happening to African Americans. And it, you know, basically wiped out all but something like 15 million acres of farmland owned by African Americans in this period.
Incredible.
And, you know, it's a double crime because not only was this land taken away, but this very land exploded in price. So if you're a white family who has, you know, owned land in Iowa or someplace like that for over 100 years, and, you know, you've financed your way into getting more and more land, you have a bigger piece of land, you're now sitting on an investment, basically an asset that's worth millions and millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
You can use that to, you know, fund your kids' education. You can use it to fund your vacation to Florida or your second home in Florida.
Sure.
All these things, investing in things that create more wealth. And this is completely taken out from under African Americans in this period. And so that kind of gets us up to date with the story. Making a long story very short. But, you know, basically, with this crime in mind, this sort of systematic dispossession, there had been a movement in the past couple of years to get debt relief to present day existing African American farmers, the remnant who are able to hold out in this sort of century long dispossession. And so a lot of folks have. They've got debt and, you know, under not very good terms from the USDA. They got smaller loans. They've had trouble paying them off. you know, various farm crises. You know, we were in a really brutal farm crisis, sure. as you know, during the pandemic.
Yeah, of course.
You know, and also in the years leading up to the pandemic, just low commodity prices. So Cory Booker comes up with this broader plan called the Justice for Black Farmers Act that included an incredibly ambitious bill, never got anywhere in the Senate, but
right.
it included $5 billion in debt relief for Black farmers. That later got into one of the COVID relief bills of 2021. Right. It passed. It was going to happen in 2021. Black farmers were told you're going to get your debt, or at least a big portion of your debt, wiped out this year. And then, you know, just some really racist sort of culture war type forces took up this battle, and you know we're basically like white farmers are being discriminated against.
Yeah,
you know, here's $5 billion that you can't get your paws on, and they drummed up this this sort of culture war, and launched a bunch of lawsuits. And yep. a couple of those lawsuits, you know, they did. I have a piece on this. They did a really good job of venue shopping, finding sympathetic, you know, Trump or George W. Bush appointed judges, and basically got these programs frozen. And so this debt relief was, you know, has been frozen ever since, and causing just incredible frustration in this community. And so, you know, Booker has been working on a solution to it. And, he got in, you know, by the skin of his teeth into this Inflation Reduction Act. He got in a total of $5 billion that will go to debt relief for, I think the language is socially disadvantaged farmers. And so basically what they did was they took racial language out of the equation and just made right. it about socially disadvantaged farmers. And that there is a big overlap between Black farmers and socially disadvantaged farmers, just, you know, people really behind them there on their debt payments. And so a big portion of this $5 billion will go to African-American farmers. And from what I've heard and talking to people, it is going to, you know, it's not vulnerable to legal challenge. And in fact, you know, Stephen Miller, just the, you know, terrible
yes.
White House aide to President Trump, who was responsible for a lot of his really awful immigration policies. You know, he started a 501c4, you know, after 2020, and he has been driving these lawsuits. And he basically declared victory when this came out. Like, we got, you know, it's no longer, you know, directed towards African-American farmers. And so I think it's actually going to happen. It leaves in its wake an incredible amount of frustration and dissatisfaction among a lot of Black farmers. But
sure.
I leave, you know, thinking that it's probably the best that could be done. I mean, this is something that, you know, If these rulings had been appealed and had gone to the Supreme Court, it's very easy to see the current Supreme Court siding with these
absolutely.
People. And, you know, it's just, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, Katie. Like, if you want to, yeah. like to haul out, you know, just some farmer from Missouri who feels like he or she has been, some, you know, white farmer from Missouri who claims to have been discriminated against. You can go on the Environmental Working Group website and just look up how many subsidies they've gotten over the years.
And, yeah, I know, right?
And, you know, there's also a lot of great research on, you know, basically how the USDA farm programs, I mean, now I'm talking about not just loans, but, you know, subsidies, direct payments.
Subsidies, yes, absolutely.
Conservation programs. These are all captured by white farmers at a rate of something like 97, 98, 99%. So it's just a ludicrous case that this little pot of $5 billion,
right.
you know, is somehow discriminating against. You know, my favorite thing was Fox News did a piece, a segment at this farm in Missouri, and it was this couple, and they were just complaining about how they were being, you know, pushed out of this, And they're literally standing behind these giant combines, like worth hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
And just talking about how abused they are. And I did for one of my pieces, go onto the EWG site and just show like these people are no stranger to government support. Let me tell you
right.
that.
I know they love the government. They love the government as long as it's, you know, paying them, and they hate the government telling them anything that they should do in order to acquire those payments. But anyway, we got a lot to cover here. So I want to talk for a second about ethanol, because it appears that we're going to be upping the ante on ethanol. And this, we're going to raise the amount of ethanol in a gallon of gas from 10% to 15%. And you and I have talked a lot about how ethanol is not the answer to our energy issues, and that there's, you know, this whole ancillary program that is of carbon capture and building pipelines through people's farms and stuff like that. We've covered that kind of stuff. But like, I mean, more corn is not what we need here. So, I mean, when are we going to see the light here? And then you also mentioned in your piece the 45Q tax break, which is particularly egregious in my mind. So let's talk first just a second about that, and then we'll move on to universal lunch.
I just get so mad about this, Katie. I mean, it's so stupid.
It's an unbelievable story. It really is.
I mean, you know, let's just take a big picture look. We can all agree, or at least most of us can agree, that we have to get off of fossil fuels.
Right.
And that means transitioning to an electric transportation system.
Right.
And whether that's electric cars, I think we should really invest a lot in rapid transit that's electric driven, try to get people away from cars as much as possible. But cars are with us. We're going to need to transition to electric cars. And so where does ethanol fit into that? Because ethanol is basically an appendage to gasoline.
Right.
Like, no one's talking about 100% ethanol. It's either 10% or 15% of the mix is ethanol. And so it's just, you know, basically an appendage to gasoline. It's not getting us anywhere. There's been a lot of incredible studies recently. I know you've had her on your show before. Leah Douglas, who writes for Reuters, just did an extraordinary piece about 2 weeks ago about how much carbon emissions is generated at ethanol plants. They generate an amazing amount of carbon. And when you look at the whole life cycle, it turns out that ethanol is not even less greenhouse gas intensive than gasoline.
How could it be?
It's just a loser.
I mean, the whole from seed to harvesting, just, you know, that amount of corn, like the amount of pesticides, the amount of herbicides, the amount of fertilizer, the amount of water involved, and then all of the gas that it takes to plant and harvest it, and then all the energy it takes to convert it to ethanol. I mean, this is just a giant giveaway to the corn industry. I mean, these people, you know, and it does not improve fuel efficiency by any stretch.
No. So, in fact, we should say that a gallon of ethanol contains 2/3 the energy of a gallon of gasoline.
Right.
And so we are reducing, we're reducing mileage when we use ethanol. And,
there
you go. We definitely need to use less gasoline. The way to do that is not to replace the gasoline with ethanol. It's to use less gasoline, period.
Right. Have a hybrid car. Have an electric car. I mean, that's the direction. It's just, there's no arguing with that logic, and yet somehow our nation is unable to get out from under these industry giants who control our politics. It's sad.
Yeah, and then you got the Biden administration, who understands this, who is, you know, pushing as hard as they can,
right,
to transition to electric vehicles. But the same administration is also, like you said, the EPA is about to raise this ceiling to 15% for ethanol.
And you have Tom Vilsack, who's telling them what to do.
And
Joe
Tom
Manchin.
Vilsack is, he's a, you know, just a huge enthusiast for ethanol. Joe Manchin doesn't care about ethanol because Joe Manchin knows that it doesn't pose any threat to the fossil fuel industry. So he's willing to sign off on it. But yeah, it's just this, these contradictory policies that if you talk to any anyone who can take it all a big picture look, just sort of get your head out of the corn belt and just sort of go one level above that and look at the whole system.
Yeah.
You see that ethanol is a total loser and that we need to be transitioning away from it not doubling down
and
on
not,
it.
Exactly.
But of course, we're doubling down on it.
Yeah, we are. So let's move on. You're going to come back. We'll talk about this again. No universal free lunch, which was so successful during the pandemic. I don't understand how this serves the national interest. So I wanted you to talk for just a second about the correlation between adequate nutrition for, you know, underserved or low-income kids and better educational outcomes. I mean, what did the universal free lunch cost, that program? Compare that to the giveaways to corporations in Wall Street, like the carried interest loophole, which is going to cost us billions of dollars more than a universal free lunch program.
Yeah, I mean, it's really pretty shocking, actually.
It's unconscionable.
Yeah, so the numbers I came up with were that the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, they figured that extending universal free lunch would have cost about $650 million, not billion, million dollars, less than $1 billion annually. Just as an example that I put in there that I thought was pretty poignant, Senator Sinema out of Arizona, let's not even talk about her any more than we have to. But, you know, she hates taxing rich people. That's one of her things.
Yes.
And there was an attack. There was an attempt to close this loophole in the tax code that literally hedge fund managers and private equity managers benefit from.
Yes.
And it costs the Treasury about $1.4 billion a year.
Oh,
and so
God.
Basically, if they had kept that in there, it's called the carried interest loophole, let's call it. It would have benefited the U.S. Treasury to the point of $1.4 billion a year. In other words, it could have funded twice what it would have cost for universal free lunch.
Right.
So absolutely stupid. That is literally taking food out of the mouths of kids and putting it into the bank, you know, sort of converting it into money and putting it into the bank accounts of these filthy rich people. I mean, come on. But let's talk a little bit about the current system and why I think universal free is so important. So as most people will know, we have a system now in public schools where there's three tiers. You pay full price,
right?
You get a reduced price, or you get free lunch. And to qualify for free lunch, you have to show your family makes a certain low level of income, that maybe there's some government programs that you already qualify for. And that creates this incredible stigma. And, you know, this has been going on since I was a kid. I'm 55 years old. When I was in public schools in the 70s and 80s, it was the same thing.
Yep.
And so, you know, the free lunch kids, I didn't stigmatize them, but we knew who they were. The guy doesn't have to pay. And it's just, you know, horrific for those kids. We've seen, this didn't happen when I was a kid, but we've seen this thing of lunch shaming, and that's kids who are on the reduced program who don't have money to pay it, and so their cafeteria and their school just lets them go through, but it's, you know, building up a ledger of debt every time they do it.
That's right.
And then you know, sending their parents threatening letters, and then giving them special lunches that are different from everyone else, that are really basic. Here's what you get because you have debt. I mean, it's unbelievable.
It's incredible.
You know, it's a sign of a very cruel society.
Oh, absolutely. We had an incident here in Warwick, Rhode Island, about a year and a half ago, in which, there was a huge amount of lunch debt. And the guy who runs Chobani heard about this on the news, and he paid the debt for every single family. You just paid the school. And it was, I mean, it brought the whole system sort of into stark relief for, you know, the American consumer, especially for, you know, middle-class people who probably don't have any awareness of this. But it really made it clear that this is just not something you can do. I mean, the kids who were on the reduced lunch who had debt were getting peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and that was it. And a, and a bottle of water. I mean, it was like really, you know, not nutritious food, not enough food. You know, it was just, it was disgusting. And let me ask you this. Do you have any sense of a way, has anyone figured out a way to calculate the loss of earning potential for kids who are going hungry because they don't qualify for free lunch or can't access free lunch?
I am confident that kind of research has happened, but I can't cite any. But I do know that there is a lot of good research about the level of quality, you know, the sort of quality level of lunch and learning attainment, educational achievement. There's really solid research on that. So this is something that's been studied, and, you know, this investment of an extra, you know, less than $1 billion a year would deliver benefits to society. But, you know, I want to bring up another aspect of it, because I went to my beloved elementary school, Pecan Springs Elementary School in Northeast Austin in 2019. I visited there and I did a podcast segment for the late and lamented Bite podcast. So Austin, it turns out, Austin has this really progressive, smart lunch director named Annalise Tanner. And she's just really, really good at, you know, figuring out how to get the best quality food on the table for these public school kids. And so she was utilizing this program where you can get an entire school to have universal free lunch if it meets certain criteria of, you know, income level of the student. If a certain number of the students, their families come from low income levels, you can get the entire school to have universal free lunch. So it's basically a pilot program for just making lunch, you know, universally free everywhere. And so one of the things I learned from Annalise was that when the district, when the cafeteria has universal free lunch, that brings a lot more resources into the cafeteria. Like the amount of money, because a lot of kids will, you know, if they have
skip lunch. If they have to
skip lunch or whatever.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. And so what she found was in the schools like Pecan Springs, which has a very high African-American population, Hispanic population, very, very high poverty levels around there. And, you know, it's one of those cases where you think of Austin as like this booming tech town with all these rich people, but there's massive inequality in a place like Austin.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of flight of rich people from public schools into private schools. And so you get this remainder public school system that's pretty low on resources and has a high rates of poverty. And so what she found was that in her schools where she's able to get universal free lunch, they have more resources. They're able to buy better quality stuff. They're able to pool their resources and buy from local farmers. And they're able to make lunches that just taste a whole lot better.
Right.
And, you know, I remember when I was a kid, you know, I was joking with her about how, you know, we would have stuff like Salisbury steak, which is basically kind of a mystery meat.
Yes.
Or, you know, reheated frozen pizza, stuff like that. And we didn't think so much of the school lunches back then. But she is serving like decent, humane food, like a very well done burrito is what we had on the day that I went there. It was like nice carrots, and kids were actually eating it. This is like, you know, I think it was fifth graders who were eating it on the day that I was there in the cafeteria. And there's no concept of lunch shaming. There's not this three tiered system. And when someone like that, who's got her aesthetic of, you know, let's bring quality to the fore here and not just try to cut costs, you can get, you know, the start of a decent school lunch system in the United States. And so I was really excited during the pandemic when they moved to universal free. And it's just so disappointing that even with the Democrats having the presidency and the House and the Senate, barely, that we can't get universal free lunch through. I mean, it's just mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling, and it is incredibly short-sighted. I mean, if we don't want to sort of drop into, I don't, I don't want, I, you know, I, I don't want to degrade other countries, but, you know, we're basically lowering our national IQ by failing to serve children adequate nutrition. It's literally that simple. And, you know, we already have a crappy educational system, as far as I'm concerned. We've been starving it for the last 60 years and or 50 years since Reagan, basically. Everything is Reagan's fault. But you know what I mean? It's like, really, how low do we need to go in this country before we realize that we have made these massive policy blunders and that, you know, feeding the rich and starving the poor is not the answer? We got to take a short break here. We'll be right back with Tom Philpott. We're going to talk about this incredible tripling of funding for the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities. And we're going to unpack what all of that means. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Okay, so I was reading through the state-by-state breakdown of these projects. This is, for those who haven't really followed this, this is a USDA program, administered program, absolutely huge. It was originally slated for like $1.2 billion, something like that, Tom. And then it was tripled to over $3 billion because there were so many applications for programs or I don't know, what do they want to call this? Partnerships. The interest was so enormous across the United States that they decided to award them a lot more money than they had originally. So I'm reading through the state-by-state breakdown, which everybody can do. You can go, you know, look up this Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities. You'll go to the USDA website, and then you can pop onto the list of how each state, what each state is going to be participating in and what is important. So, of course, I looked right away at the state of Iowa, because Iowa is, you know, drowning in hog waste, drowning in agrochemicals, stripped of topsoil, and has dwindling water supplies. These are all issues that, you know, definitely have an impact on our climate overall. Hog waste is an enormous emitter of greenhouse gases and VOCs, as we all know. So I didn't see one single thing that addressed hog waste. But what I did see was the following, and I'm going to read it to you. The National Pork Board is the lead partner. Is advancing U.S. pork sustainability and market value proposal. The goal of this project is to increase the sustainability of U.S. pork products by advancing climate smart agriculture practices within the feed supply, thereby maintaining market demand and price premiums in a rapidly evolving consumer world. So what this looks like to me, and this also goes to Minnesota, Iowa, and Missouri, all three of those states, which are very much involved in pork production, and the production of corn and soy, the two primary feed ingredients for any hog thing. And so the major partners of the National Pork Board, Nestle, Sustainable Environmental Consultants, Ducks Unlimited, Trust in Food, which is the Farm Journal, about which I'd love to talk to you off the air.
Okay.
Farm Credit Council, Millborn Seed, and the major commodities affected are pork, rice, soybeans, and corn. This is a $20 million funding for this climate smart agriculture practices within the feed supply. First of all, before we get to this, I'm sorry, I got ahead of myself. What do they mean by climate smart commodities? We're talking about, like, how do you make farming corn, soy, pork, rice climate smart? Can you break that down for me?
I mean, what this is, and we're going to be seeing a lot of this going forward, is a major effort to get the status quo renamed as sustainable or climate smart.
Right.
And so basically to take current practices, which are extremely destructive, as you mentioned, and sort of market them as sustainable. Now, what I'm guessing is happening here is, you know, the feed supply chain for the pork industry is corn and soybeans.
Right.
And I'm guessing it's throwing a little bit of money at stuff like cover crops and, you know, strips of prairie grass where, you know, soil's going to erode, where it erodes mm-hmm. every year. These marginal things that are beneficial at the margin, but they're not going to stop the huge problems that are going on in that area, which include, right. as you mentioned, water pollution by just excessive amounts of hog manure getting dropped onto land and not being able to, they're putting so much on it, it doesn't soak up, over application of fertilizers, over application of other pesticides and stuff like that, that get into the water and make the water in that area a total nightmare. Yeah. There may be some very marginal improvements in that stuff, but it is not changing the overall equation. But what it is doing is putting the USDA stamp on it as climate smart and, you know, lining some folks' pockets with this $20 million. It really isn't right. going to be doing much. And I think that the broad context for this, Katie, I did a piece last year on this. So European Union is doing this thing called, what is it called? They have a thing called the farm to fork strategy in the European Union. And
yes.
what they're trying to do is say, okay, we know we need to use less fertilizer and less agrochemicals. Let's create some targets and, you know, mandate some cuts by a certain date and see how it goes. And, you right. know, if you tell me, if I'm a farmer and you tell me that I have to decrease my fertilizer use by 40%, that could, you know, over time, that could unleash a lot of really interesting innovation. Okay, well, I have to cut down on fertilizer. Maybe if I add another legume to my crop rotation,
right?
I'll fix some nitrogen that way.
Fix more nitrogen in the soil, right? Right.
Yeah, and instead of just doing corn and soybeans, I'll do corn, soybeans, and you know, I don't know, alfalfa mixed with you know,
oats.
Hay or something like
that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, oats or something like that. And you know, maybe because it'll be more efficient, I'll rotate some cows onto my pasture and they can essentially harvest this cover crop by just eating it and deposit their manure in the land. Instead of like having giant feedlots, we'll have maybe fewer animals and we'll, you know, put them back on the land where we know that they can actually make a positive difference. And so it would, you know, that kind of strategy, I mean, it can be done very badly, but it could also be done well in a way that incentivizes people to innovate and come up with new systems that use less of these chemicals.
Sure.
Well, Vilsack gets word of this and he's freaked out and he's basically like, no, we cannot support that. We're not going to do it. And he, you know, starts this movement of other countries who are going to band together and say, we're not going to do the farm to fork strategy. We're going to not regulate at all. We're going to get to net zero in all these other ways. And I just thought it was hilarious, the countries that he was able to get on board with this strategy.
You mean like, I don't know, North Korea?
Okay, well, you got Brazil.
Saudi Arabia.
you got, well, yeah, not too far. You got Brazil,
sure.
which is
oh,
completely
right.
given over to industrial scale agriculture.
Absolutely.
Where right. the pesticide and fertilizer companies run the roost, where they're literally, you know, the right-wing government is literally kicking indigenous people off of land.
Burning the rainforest as fast as they can, yeah.
They're eating up the rainforest. They're eating up the savanna, which is incredibly biodiverse and has lots of carbon in it. So that's one of our partners. Another one is United Arab Emirates.
Of course.
You know, that ag powerhouse that imports, you know, some huge portion of its food because it's literally in a desert.
Right. I mean, this speaks to one of the lines in this where it says, thereby maintaining market demand and price premiums. To me, that was the critical piece of that particular entry, was it wasn't about addressing climate issues by any means. It was about maintaining market demand by kind of greenwashing, you know, whatever it is that they're going to do.
I was just going to say, it wasn't even making a claim like this will cut carbon emissions by 10%. Like that's our goal. Our goal is to maintain market demand and get a price premium.
And good prices.
Put more money into these companies' pockets.
Here's another one that just blew my mind. And then, you know, for people who were listening earlier, it goes back to the discussion we had about ethanol. The GEVO, GEVO, whatever that means, Climate Smart Farm to Flight program, this project aims to create critical structural market incentives for low carbon intensity corn, I don't know what that is, as well as to accelerate the production of sustainable aviation fuel to reduce the sector's dependency on fossil-based fuel. This project includes an immediate market opportunity to sell climate smart, low climate impact corn. So the lead partner is GEVO. I guess that's an agro, you know, biz, a corn biz. And the major partner is Southwest Iowa Renewable, Google, Farmers Edge, Earth Optics, South Dakota State University, Yardstick, WH Ag Services, AgSpire, Prairie Food, it goes on and on. And then that gets $30 million, and the major commodity is corn. Have we not established that corn is not the answer? We're not going to be able to fly freaking planes on corn. I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know what this low carbon intensity corn is. I've never heard of that before, but I'm guaranteeing you that this is never going to fly. Forgive the pun.
I mean, the idea of ethanol as aviation fuel is sort of like the next frontier, because as we, you know, everyone agrees that, you know, U.S. per capita gasoline demand is going down. There is a very probable EV revolution, electric vehicle revolution about to happen. And so they know that they have got to figure out another story besides, you know, ethanol is great for your car. And so they are dangling on the horizon that by some technological breakthrough, ethanol can somehow become an aviation fuel. And, you know, there's some big obstacles because I was saying before, a gallon of ethanol has about two-thirds the energy in a gallon of gasoline.
There you go.
And aviation fuel's got to be really dense. And so it's just sort of like figuring out some technology to make this stuff denser and more energy rich. And you know, I don't know the answer to getting aviation off of fossil fuels. You know, I've read articles that suggest that maybe electric aviation might be viable at some point. But I highly doubt the answer is going to be corn-based ethanol. I mean, it's just not. And I think people know that. I think, you know, I don't think this is something that is like this great revelation, but I think the industry is pretending like, oh, you know, don't worry about when EVs take over because we'll have this whole other huge market of aviation biofuel. But I think it's just a total fantasy.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly not anything that you and I are going to see in our lifetimes. I don't think. If we have enough soil, topsoil left to grow enough corn to power engines, we're not going to be able to do anything else. I mean, we won't be growing any animals because we won't. I mean, the whole thing just is, it shocked me. I'm going to say that. And then one more I wanted, and then we can talk sort of about some of the better parts of this program. I mean, there were some great things in this. There was a lot of money for organics and for, you know, what they call sustainable beef production. I have no idea what they mean by that. But my last one was Climate Smart, which is an acronym for Scaling Mechanisms for Agriculture's Regenerative Transformation. Uh-huh. This project, This project will reach across 28 states and aims to catalyze a self-sustaining market-based network to broaden farmer access, scale adoption of climate smart practices, and this was highlighted in my I highlighted this, sustainably produce grain and dairy commodities with verified and quantified climate benefits. The price tag on this one is $90 million. I, first of all, want to know what, you know, who is verifying, who is quantifying, and how are they doing it? I mean, we can't even figure out how to measure carbon capture, like with the old cap and trade boondoggle. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like all of this stuff, these, I read through these things. I'm just like, wow, who wrote this? Because none of it seems real to me. I mean, I just, I don't understand. Like, it's not, you know, these words, it's word salad to me. I mean, honestly, you know, self-sustaining market-based network to broaden farmer access. What? You know?
Yeah. I mean, it is very Vilsack. I think we can agree on that.
Yeah.
And when you start talking about dairy, and this is also probably true, not the program you mentioned about hogs and their feed stream.
Right.
But when you start talking about dairy and meat, it doesn't take long for you to start getting into the whole thing about methane digesters.
Right. Sure.
And so, you know, these are obviously dairy and hog production are very methane intensive. And a you big betcha. Reason for that is the giant amount of manure that gets captured in these lagoons and then is sprayed on fields. And so the industry answer, and Tom Vilsack loves this, is, okay, instead of having one lagoon, bear with me here, have two lagoons. And over the first lagoon, we'll put a, you know, tarp, essentially, like a cover.
Yep. Oh, I've
over
seen
it,
them, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we'll harvest the methane from this. So we'll go into the natural gas stream. And then once that's done, we'll take that manure and pipe it over into the next lagoon that is open pit, just like it always used to be. And we will spread that manure. We'll way over apply that manure on the land and create all kinds of problems. And so they act like it's the solution because you're taking the methane and, you know, sort of upcycling it. You're burning it as a energy source, which does, you know, that's better than letting it drift off into the atmosphere as methane, which is a very hot, you know, heat trapping greenhouse gas. But the problem is that you've concentrated the manure that's left over. It's got higher levels of ammonia. It's even stinkier because you've concentrated it.
Yeah.
And it's you know, maintaining all of these problems that it has, that it gives communities who live nearby these things when, you know, when they're spraying this stuff and they're over applying it, it gets into water. It gets into literally the mist from it gets into people's homes.
All manner of health issues. Absolutely. Oh, it's very, very dangerous.
All manner of problems. Respiratory issues. And then there is this whole thing with, you know, basically when you capture that methane, what you do is you purify it, and then it's essentially the same as natural gas, and it goes into the natural gas stream.
Yeah.
And that sounds great. It sounds like, oh, you know, we're taking this thing that was a heat trapping gas with 30 times the heat trapping power of carbon, and turning it into natural gas so we can burn. But the problem is that we know that we need to burn a lot less natural gas. And natural gas is not this benign fuel. There are methane leaks at every, you know, part of the production process. Methane is a really big greenhouse gas emitter. And so it is maintaining this reliance on natural gas at the very minute that we're trying to get off of natural gas.
Yeah.
And it also, you know, they can call it then sustainable natural gas. And,
right,
you know, this power generating facility gets 10% of its power from sustainable natural gas. And this sort of greenwashes the whole operation.
That's right.
And so, you know, in the end, I think that it's basically a climate loser and it's terrible for the communities. And Tom Vilsack is a big proponent of these methane digesters. And I think a lot of this stuff is going to come down to subsidies to create, you know, to convince farmers to put these digesters in. And, you know, it's when a dairy executive like Vilsack was before he became USDA chief again, when they say we're going to get to net zero by 2050, what they mean is we're going to have methane digesters on every dairy. And it's just not a great situation. And, you know, Smithfield is doing this, the giant pork company is doing this in Eastern North Carolina. They've got a project brewing to, you know, put methane digesters in these giant CAFOs that are in African-American communities that are causing all kinds of environmental injustice issues, essentially putting lipstick on a pig. That's a little bit on the nose of a metaphor or cliche, but
I'm down with that one. I think that works really well in this case. Well, we should probably wrap this up. We've gone a bit over time. I hope people have been able to sustain that. You know, like, I know we should all appreciate the fact that, you know, we're supporting that agriculture is on the table, that people are talking about ways to try to improve it. And, you know, there was some good money in there for, I guess, good projects. I'm not really, frankly, educated enough to totally understand it. But I was disappointed that I didn't see any money that, you know, went towards things like re-regionalizing food systems or building a more robust supply chain, expanding local processing, distribution, the things that would cut down, like materially cut down on fossil fuel use because you're not transporting food by, you know, thousands of miles and would reduce water consumption for the same, you know, all of that stuff. And it would make us less vulnerable to supply chain disruption from, you know, weather events or pandemics, for instance. So I just, you know, it's just like sad to me that we're taxpayers are funding these massive influxes of money to essentially prop up industries that are, you know, making enormous profits at the expense of all the rest of us. And that's very discouraging, particularly, you know, given that we are really at this kind of critical moment in our history, in our evolution as humans on the planet. So,
right. Anyway. I mean, as we're recording this, the massive storm hit the coast of Alaska and caused all kinds of flooding and damage.
Oh, and massive. Did you see the photographs of the typhoon in Japan?
Massive,
oh my God.
Massive storm hit Puerto Rico. The country's without power yet again. You know, some huge portion of Pakistan is underwater.
That's right.
And this is the kind of dithering we're doing with climate policy in the United States. It's pretty disappointing.
It's pretty disappointing. Well, on that note, and I hate to be a Debbie Downer here, but that's what it is, folks. Tom, thank you so much. Come back soon. It's always a great fun to talk to you. You're so knowledgeable. I really appreciate your time. We'll see you next week, folks. And thanks for tuning in. Thanks to my sponsors. So long for now. What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.